From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A political earthquake last week in India. The ruling party of the Gandhi family crushingly defeated. The Hindu nationalist BJP, the longtime opposition party, now resoundingly in charge. And at its head, the charismatic, super pro-business, one-time tea seller Narendra Modi, who will now lead the world's biggest democracy. This hour on Point, Modi's India. On Friday, people flooded the streets of Modi's home province of Gujarat, chanting Modi, Modi, after the BJP landslide victory. Their forum, 12 years, he headed up that state. Here's a supporter of Modi in Gujarat, interpreted by PBS.
There is no one else capable for the prime minister's post. For the country's security, it is very essential for Modi to become the prime minister.
And here's Narendra Modi himself from a victory speech on Friday.
I thank all of you from my heart, and I salute all of you. You all have carried out a great responsibility. Today, in the history of 60 years of Indian democracy, you have created a new record.
Joining me now from New Delhi in India is Annie Gowan, India correspondent for The Washington Post. Annie Gowan, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being with us. What's the mood there these couple of days now after this very, very big vote?
The Modi was overwhelmingly elected, right? So his supporters are thrilled, and they're really looking forward to his being sworn in as prime minister later this week. But you know, then there's the people that are concerned about his past and worried about his Hindu nationalist leanings that are very, very depressed. So there's a mix. But I would say, by and large, the country is very excited and sort of looking forward to this new era.
Annie, how do you describe the circumstances that led to this kind of political earthquake here? What's the mood change in India that produced it, or the problem that Modi has been elected to address?
Well, the Indian economy has slowed in recent years. And, you know, for many years when the economy was growing at such a rapid clip in the early 2000s, you know, there was a sense of real hope and optimism. And Indians felt like they were finally going to take their place on the world stage where they belong and as the world's most populous democracy. And, you know, in recent years, that feeling has declined. And, you know, I think that Modi really tapped into that aspirational hope that many Indians have. I want a better life. I want, you know, we want to be part of the global democracy, you know, the global, you know, global world, global democracy. And so he really tapped into that mood, I think, and took advantage of it.
His reputation is very, very pro-business. Clear away all red tape, do whatever it takes. He did this in Gujarat to let business flourish. He's promised 100 new cities, high-speed rail. What's it going to take for him to deliver nationally, Annie?
Well, Gujarat is a state in Western India, and he had a lot of power there, a lot of autonomy to do what he wanted to do. And so now he'll be taking over, you know, a much larger country with lots of diverse people and landscape and other regional power centers, other regional leaders that are very powerful. So it may be more difficult for him to deliver on the national stage in the same way that he did in his little fiefdom there in Gujarat.
There were terrible riots in Gujarat in 2002. Many, many Muslims died. Thousands, some say 2,000. He never apologized for that. The United States barred him from traveling to the U.S. for a long time after that. What about the fears of Modi representing a Hindu supremacist vision of India?
Well, the Muslims, there's 14% of India's population are Muslims, and that's one community that's very afraid, you know, that they'll be marginalized, that they may be increasing targets of racism, you know, by Modi supporters and nationalist supporters. So I think people do realize that Modi's an ambitious person. He spent the last 12 years trying to put this sort of stain on his career behind him, and I think people are willing to give him the benefit of the doubt and see what happens.
Let's go right to his party. Annie Gowan with The Washington Post in New Delhi. Thank you very much for joining us, Annie.
Thank you.
With us now from the Indian capital, New Delhi, is Jahant Sinha. He's part of the landslide. Just won a seat in parliament for Modi's BJP in the state of Jharkhand along the Ganges River west of Calcutta. He's part of Narendra Modi's inner circle, an ex-Harvard Business School guy and businessman in the United States, now in the thick of Indian politics. Jahant Sinha, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
Why do you think
glad to be on the show.
It's great to have you. Why do you think the BJP has won in such a landslide?
It's very simple, Tom. I think the people of India are looking for good governance and development, and we were the only party that made it very clear that that was the agenda that we were pursuing. And what we said about good governance and development was also very credible to the people of India. And that's why I think they endorsed us with such a decisive mandate.
Why do you think the Indian economy has slowed so? And what policies from the BJP and Narendra Modi might turn it around?
I think there are really two reasons why the Indian economy has slowed as much as it has. I think first and foremost is that there was, in fact, an utter lack of leadership from the current Congress government in terms of tackling the problems of the economy and so on. And so as a result of that, many important reform measures didn't go through. Many important initiatives in terms of fostering and furthering economic growth did not go through. So I think that was one very important reason. I think the second very important reason also is that this government, in fact, was fighting in its second term to free itself of a number of very, very, terrible corruption scandals that erupted, all of which had, in fact, most of them had erupted in their first term. So from the beginning, they were on the defensive when their second term started in 2009, and they were completely fighting these rearguard battles trying to protect their image and their reputation. And with the lack of leadership that they have, the combination of constantly being on the defensive and fighting all these corruption scandals, as well as not having the leadership to be able to deal with the problems that emerged, resulted in complete non-performance in their second term of office.
Jahant Sinha, your party leader, Narendra Modi, is famously a great admirer of China, the Chinese model of economic development and growth. But of course, China is Communist Party directed, top-down, non-democratic. Can that impulse, that approach, work in democratic India?
I mean, I would not. I think you've drawn together a false inference here, just saying that because the China model of economic growth has demonstrated results, therefore it will create problems in democratic India. I think Mr. Modi is a great Democrat. He's won any number of elections, and he's won a wonderful election, the greatest election in the history of humanity. He's just won that election. He's a great Democrat, and he's won it by appealing to our better natures and by saying that, it's governance and development. I mean, I heard Annie say earlier in the show that there is this talk of him being divisive and so on. I can assure you during this election, there was none of that. And in fact, it was an election that was fought entirely on the principle of providing people the good governance and development that they deserve. And so as a great Democrat, as the recognition of India's diversity and plurality, I can assure you that the economic reform measures and the economic results that we've seen in the Chinese economy will be done in an Indian way. I think it's wrong to insinuate that there is a Chinese way of doing things and he'll adopt the Chinese way. I think that's a wrong insinuation. The reality is that it's going to be done the Indian way, which is pluralistic and which is diverse and which is inclusive of all sections of society. And Mr. Modi has been very clear in his campaign in emphasizing that.
We wish India all the best with good governance, absolutely, and development. Still plenty of poverty and more to be addressed there. What about concerns, though, about the political roots of Narendra Modi's career? It is in the Hindu nationalist movement, very proudly so. India, of course, all countries have tensions. India has had its ethnic, religious, cultural tensions there. In his own Gujarat, deadly riots while he was the man in charge. So concerning that the U.S. cut him off from getting a visa to visit here. Should non-Hindus feel worried about this leadership?
I think non-Hindus should not feel worried at all about this leadership. In fact, after 2002, there have been virtually no riots at all in Gujarat. There's been a tremendous peace and prosperity in Gujarat after that. You also have to remember that the 2002 riots happened when Mr. Modi had just assumed office, just
yes.
A few months after he'd assumed office as a first-time chief minister. And it really was something that spun out of control in a terrible way. And of course, we have these tensions and challenges in India. But therefore, to assume that, you know, this is going to happen in India because it happened 12 years ago in Gujarat. By the way, there have been many, many riots and problems in India subsequently in Congress states as well. In fact, in Assam recently, we had a terrible massacre. And Assam, of course, is a Congress-ruled state. So
yes.
I think, again, you know, it's a false insinuation to go from 2002 to 2014 and start to believe that this is what's going to happen. Again, Mr. Modi has been very clear that he wants to take along everyone and ensure development for everyone. And, you know, this Hindu nationalist tag that's always put on the Bharatiya Janata Party, I think it's a shorthand that the Western or the global press uses. But I don't think the Bharatiya Janata Party is any more a Hindu nationalist party than the U.S. Republicans, and of course I spent 20 years in the U.S., I know in U.S. politics extremely well, it's no more than what the U.S. Republicans do or the Tories do in the U.K. I mean, you know, everybody in the U.S. talks about Christian faith and, you know, Christian values, and all of those are very much part of the campaign rhetoric in the U.S. and in the U.K. So you could call the Republicans or the Tories Christian nationalists by that same set of standards. So while it's a convenient label to use for the BJP is a modern center-right party, which is completely and utterly secular.
Jahan Sinha, we wish you congratulations on your recent victory. We wish good luck to India under its new government. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
Jahan Sinha, newly elected member of parliament, is part of the BJP landslide in India. The victory song of the BJP behind us right here. Listeners, you can join us. What do you see unfolding in India? 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about India's historic opposition party landslide win last week and the coming government of its charismatic leader, Narendra Modi, Hindu nationalist, top-down growth guy, steamroller, some say, definitely inspired an enormous victory in India, where the economy has been flagging, where people clearly in this vote want something more, something different. Here's a man on the street in New Delhi wearing a shirt with Modi's face on it, telling China's CCTV why he supported Modi and the BJP.
I think, first of all, the country was going through a dark patch on the economic front, on the foreign policies itself, on the jobs. So first of all, you know, everything has to be come in the place.
And here's Modi himself in his victory speech on Friday, interpreted by the BBC, saying he will lead a government for the whole people.
Any government doesn't belong to a group, to a community. No real government doesn't belong to a community. It belongs to the country. It doesn't belong to a particular caste and creed. A government is for the entire people.
From Narendra Modi's victory speech on Friday in India. Let's look at the economic side of all this. The promises there are large. Expectations are high. With us now from New York is Prashant Agrawal, investment manager at Alex Partner. He's author of There's a Simple Reason Narendra Modi Will Be India's Next Prime Minister in Quartz. He was right. Prashant Agrawal, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
What's the change in approach that Modi's ascension foretells or would have you expecting in India?
There are a couple of things that will be different under this regime. One, you're going to have a clear vision and clear policies. In the last government, you had a moving ball often for businesses. And business can't operate without a clear set of guidelines and policies. So for instance, 2-3 years ago, the finance ministry announced that they could look back at any deal till 1962 and announce retroactive taxes. That scared foreign investors. That scared Indian investors. Indian companies started to look outside of India for investment. Modi is going to change that. Gujarat was open for business. Now India is open for business.
Gujarat became a kind of red carpet, welcome mat out for business place, and it brought in lots of foreign investment, brought lots of Indians to do business there. Of course, the flip side of that was his policies were not exactly, I guess, pro-labor. He made land acquisition much bigger, which can be a very fraught issue in India.
Is there a downside if you're not on the, you know, booming business side of the equation with Narendra Modi?
I don't think so, Tom. I think you've raised a very important point in the Indian context, and that is land acquisition. Land acquisition in India is fraught with multiple difficulties. And if you look at Narendra Modi and the model that he had in Gujarat, that's actually been espoused by the Supreme Court of India as a model for the rest of India.
We should make clear the problem there. Very often you have people living quite marginal lives, eking out an agricultural subsistence, and you need a place to build a factory. They don't have power. Factory owner might. In Gujarat, it wasn't hard to come in and get that land. Elsewhere, it can be difficult.
So the difficulty is exactly what you said, Tom. You have, if you need 10 acres of land in the U.S. or Western world, you may go to one person or two people to buy that land. In India, there may be 1,000, there may be 1,500 people with very little acreage, or, you know, I mean, not a tenth of an acre, but less than that. So you actually have to sit there and negotiate with everyone. There are ways to do this fairly to make sure that the farmers are compensated, that they move from subsistence living to actually having a piece of the pie. In Gujarat, I think by all accounts, you were able to do two things. You were able to fairly compensate farmers or other landowners in a way that they were happy, and you were able to get manufacturing the land they needed in a timely manner. He also often did this with government land, making sure that the land got fair value. The Indian, you know, the largest landowner in India, as it is in many places, the government. And there is lots and lots of unused land that can be used for manufacturing. And that is also the need of the hour in India. You have 12 million people each year that come online that need new jobs. To give a sense of that, there's 10 million unemployed in the U.S. India, just forget the unemployed. It needs to make 12 million new jobs each year for every 16-year-old that comes online and needs to be part of the economy.
India kind of ran out of gas for some reason economically. What happened there? Why did its big growth slow down? Did it bump up against some kind of ceiling with its old approach? What was that?
Yeah, that's a great question. So if I was living in India for the last 12 years, and what became quite clear was that India was facing policy paralysis. Jayanth mentioned the corruption that India faced. The corruption that India faced was incredible in its scale. The corruption was – India moved from one corruption scandal to one corruption scandal, and it was $10 billion at one scandal for Colgate, then $20 billion for another scandal. And what you ended up having was everybody scared to do anything. So bureaucrats didn't want to move any paper, any projects, because they were scared they were going to get criticized or go to jail or do anything. Ministers didn't want to do anything. In the last since 2010, you've just had nothing move in India. Big projects have been stalled. Small projects have been stalled. And that's what we hope, you know, that's what Indians have hoped would change, is that you would have those projects now move.
Modi is a big admirer of China. I suggested, you may have heard, to one of his advisors there that he liked that top-down Chinese model and got pushback on that. But he says, you know, he has said he wants to build 100 new cities. Now, India is a billion plus, so there's room for a lot of cities. He wants to put high-speed rail all over the country. That takes land, of course. What about it? Will he bring a top-down approach that, I understand the frustration with red tape, but is it consistent with democratic governance?
So I think what he's an admirer of, and he has gone to China several times, is the economic growth of China.
Sure.
Now, how he's done it in Gujarat is somewhat the same and somewhat different. He does believe in infrastructure. He admires China's infrastructure projects, and India needs that. He can't do what China does in the Indian democratic framework, but he does believe in an Indian model of growth, which is a mix of China. Let's have big infrastructure projects, what you talked about. There are 6 dedicated freight corridors in India right now. The Indian railways used to be the admiration of the world. Now it's antiquated. You have accidents every week. I mean, if you have 20 people die, it doesn't even make news anymore in India. It's just expected, and that's unacceptable. And I think that's what he's going to try to change on the infrastructure side and emulate China. On the flip side, he is a private sector champion, and he wants small, medium, and large businesses to grow. He comes from a state of businessmen, and I think that he's going to infuse India with that can-do business spirit. and cut down the red tape that's there in India.
Prashant Agarwal in New York, stand by. It's great to have you with us. Callers, and then we'll go back to India in just a moment. Geeta in Arlington, Massachusetts. Geeta, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hello. Recently,
two of my friends stood for elections, one of them in Barrackpore, Calcutta. Her party workers and she herself were threatened. Some of her party workers were beaten. Nobody said anything about it. She stood for the Communist Party and lost. The other one was a journalist, Siddharth Vardarajan, very respected. He was the ex-editor of The Hindu, which is a very respected newspaper in the South. He was threatened by goons for having spoken out his mind and not supporting Modi publicly.
How does it relate to Narendra Modi himself?
To the fact that Mr. Modi oversaw and was the chief minister at the time of the Gujarat riots. He never apologized publicly. When incidents like this happen, one does not have any faith in the fact that he would even stop a campaign or even make a report about it in public, because this is very biased. Muslims in India do not support him. Not a single Muslim is represented as an MP. I don't see how he can represent people when he cannot stop certain kinds of violence, even the small kinds in his mind, which is just related to side election.
Geeta,
and secondly,
yes.
I would like to say one more thing, is that to give the tag that he is the Hindutva tag to him by the global press is not true. I grew up in Kanpur, India, and next door my uncle belonged to the RSS. They used to practice in the same way as they do with the RSS, you know, with sticks and just...
This is a kind of Hindu extremist group that Mr. Modi was closely associated with, part of.
Yes, yes, next door. And luckily for me and for my mind, my parents never, even though we're a very close family, they never associated with this kind of politics. And I grew up looking at it as a kind of a funny thing, you know, like it could be Charlie Chaplin making these kinds of little practices of, you know, being like a little Hitler. But I don't think that Mr. Modi is going to be like a Hitler, but he does certainly scare people who are not in the mainstream.
Geeta, let us take it to India, if I may, and I appreciate your call very much on exactly that front. Prashant Agarwal, stand by in New York. I want to go to Gujarat, India, where Narendra Modi was for 12 years the top guy from Ahmedabad there, the city of Ahmedabad. Zahir John Muhammad joins us. He's a freelance journalist. He's covered Narendra Modi for more than a decade. Zahir John Muhammad, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
What is the lesson out of Gujarat ultimately? The economic development was very strong. At the same time, you had riots and a lot of death there soon after Modi came to power. What's the lesson? What should we take from that about this leader?
Sure. Well, I have two concerns about Mr. Modi. The first is in respect to human rights. You know, aside from the riots, which Human Rights Watch and the U.S. State Department said that Modi failed to stop and may have been complicit, in fact. In fact, there's so many records of Muslims during the riots calling the chief minister's office, calling police officers, the police officers saying, we can't do anything, we've been given orders from above not to do anything. So first, there's human rights concerns. But I think what some of your previous speakers have said in this conversation is that aside from 2002, Gujarat has been peaceful. First of all, that's not true. There were riots in Baroda a few years ago. But what I'm more worried about, I live in a Muslim ghetto of Ahmedabad known as Jewelpur. There are about 500,000 people here. And like a lot of other Muslims in Gujarat, I couldn't find housing elsewhere. Even though I'm a U.S. citizen, I still get treated like a Muslim here. Now, in this ghetto, this Muslim ghetto, the Gujarat government has failed to provide adequate public schools. So every year, there's 2,000 school children that cannot go to school. I was at a school just a few hours earlier today where I could see a line of parents who were turned back because they can't afford the private schools or there's not enough space and the Gujarat government isn't providing. The second thing is the Gujarat government hasn't built roads in this area. It hasn't built sewage lines. So when Modi talks on Friday and you played the clip about he wants to bring all Indians forward, I don't see that.
But Zahir, Muslims alone constitute, what, 15% of this country of a billion plus. I mean, you can't really leave that many people behind, can you, or outside?
I mean, you know, it is very possible that Modi might change. He'll have to change. You know, this is like the transition going from being a congressman to a senator or a senator to president. So he will have to change. He will have to moderate. But, you know, I prefer to judge Modi based on his record over the last 12 years as chief minister of Gujarat. And on that record, I see two glaring faults. Number one is a disregard for human rights. Aside from just the issue of Muslims, there's concerns about Christians being intimidated and being put on lists. There's concerns about women's surveillance of women. There's concerns about journalists who try to, and I've had problems myself, try to report against Modi, are intimidated. But there's also concerns about economics. I mean, Prashant mentioned about the economic progress. And I agree, the Congress Party has failed miserably. They're an incredibly inept party. And there is positive growth in Gujarat. What I'm concerned about is the poor. So if you look at in Gujarat, there's this development of this massive riverfront project, which is sort of a crown jewel of Modi. They've developed a six-mile promenade. But it led to the displacement of 38,000 people, many of whom today live in makeshift housing or are homeless. The Gujarat government refused to provide them housing, just like the Gujarat government refused to release scholarships to Muslim students. It was only when the courts intervened that Modi finally relinquished and gave these riverfront residents housing.
Jahir, stand by there in Gujarat. I want to take that to Prashant Agrawal in New York. Prashant, can let's say that there is this record in Gujarat that Jahir describes to us. Can you take that to national scale and make it national policy? Can you do that to either cultural, religious minorities or to the poor and effectively lead India?
Well, a couple of things. I think Zahir is right. We have to look at Modi's 12 years as chief minister and judge him on that. And I think that's what the people of India did. They've given him a mandate that nobody has had since 1984. And if you actually look at Muslim constituencies, there are 87 constituencies in India that have more than 20% Muslim population. Modi took more than half of those. I think it's a misnomer to say now at this point that Muslims were against Modi. The people of India, including Muslims, including Christians, including Sikhs, voted overwhelmingly in favor of Modi. I think Modi does have to look at 2002, and I think if you look at the last 12 years, he's made sure that Gujarat has been as riot free as possible. Riots are an unfortunate part of 1.25 billion people living together. And I think he's going to make sure that there are as minimal riots as possible because his number one priority is economic growth. Riots stop that. He knows that. So he won't allow that. I think the other quick thing, what Zahir was saying, you know, Modi is very concerned about the poor and development. And one thing that the government and, you know, why we've seen so much frustration is the government has always been the provider of subsidy programs or welfare programs. And Rajiv Gandhi in 1984, 1983, famously said 86% of all money the government spends on welfare programs evaporates, meaning it goes to corrupt people throughout the food chain, the distribution supply chain. Modi's changed that. He's allowed the private sector to enter in and help provide services to the poor. So there's a health program in Gujarat that allows poor people health insurance and allows them to go to private doctors and gives them better health care than what was there before. And 60 million people, that's the last point. There's 60 million people in Gujarat. Gujarat would be a top 20 nation if it was a nation.
All on its own. So he's led at that scale, but then India is on another scale entirely.
Right.
India and China up there. We've got to take a short break here. Zahir John Muhammad in Ahmedabad, in Gujarat, India. We're grateful for your perspective today. Thank you very much for joining us. Prashant Agrawal, please stand by in New York. When we come back, we'll look at foreign policy issues and we'll look at the status of women in India, perhaps in Modi's India. Listeners, you can join us. Indian listeners, what do you think of Mr. Modi? Are you excited? Are you wary? What's the meaning of the political earthquake in India? Here's the number one song on the station Radio Mirchi in India. It's Offo off the soundtrack from the Indian film Two States. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about India's historic opposition party landslide win last week and the coming government of its charismatic leader, Narendra Modi. Narendra Modi could not get a visa to the United States for a long time after riots there in the year 2002. At a White House press briefing on Friday, White House Press Secretary Jay Carney said Mr. Modi is now welcome in the U.S.
I can tell you that the Prime Minister of India will be welcomed to the United States. And I would also note that U.S. officials, including Ambassador Powell, have met with Mr. Modi, so he is certainly not unknown to us.
And the U.S. Ambassador to India there, Powell. We'll look at foreign policy issues here. A couple of callers first. Hari Balan is calling from Des Moines, Iowa. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. My point is about any article, any international discussion on Modi would never go away, you know, without discussing the Gujarat riots. I want to make clear that, you know, the Supreme Court of India has found no evidence, or it has given a very clean chit about Modi's involvement on it. He doesn't, instigate or do anything about it. He did try everything on his best to control it. The Supreme Court has given this decision, which is the highest judicial court in India. And I was upset that, you know, even after that judgment, U.S. did not revoke the ban. U.S. still continued with it. So, however, now President Obama did call Modi, and, you know, things are different now.
Yes.
So I just want to, you know, I just want to bring up that any discussion about Modi, it's always about Gujarat riots, minorities. The only thing, the reason for this is Modi never does minority politics. Every politician in India starts off with minority politics. There is minority appeasement. So anything anything for the Muslims or the Christians who are, you know, the minor, the 14-15% of the population, they always do appeasement for them, like, for example, reservation, or, you know, do some schemes that would benefit that community.
Reserving particular positions in government. But I'm looking here at a letter, public letter signed by Salman Rushdie and a bunch of other prominent Indian intellectuals before the election, saying don't go with Modi, saying it would bode ill for India's future as a country that that cherishes ideals of inclusion if he were elected. I mean, you know, the concern is still out there.
Well, the question is, so those people don't have respect for the Supreme Court of India? Because the court has, and remember that 10 years it's ruled by Congress, the opposition, I mean the party, which was against Modi, and they did everything possible and the best they had to make sure this guy get implicated in the case.
Yeah, no, we've got your perspective. Absolutely. A lot of support for him, and many people saying, look, he didn't campaign on this. This is not the way he's going to go. And yet there's history and people look at it. Let me get one more right here. Ravinder's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Ravinder, you're on the air.
Yeah, thank you, Tom, for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I really love your show.
Thank you.
I am from India, and I have followed the politics of BJP and the rest of the parties of India. And mm-hmm. I'm also the avid student of history of India as well. I have a few things to say. One of the things, it's not only Gujarat riots that the Modi was involved in. Not long ago, he also evicted thousands of the Sikhs who were employed in Gujarat. He said Sikhs are not from Gujarat. They are from Punjab, and they have no right to plow that land. And I have personally known the families who were farming in Gujarat and got evicted by Modi. And also, he's from the party, not only Gujarat riots. If you look at a Babri mosque on December 6, 1982, this party also demolished the Babri mosque and slaughtered thousands of Muslims there as well. And other splinter groups this party drives the support from is like RSS, Shiv Sena, and Bajrang Dal. Not long ago, a few years ago, they had also killed a Christian missionary by the name of Staines from Australia. Him and his son was burned alive in the car as well.
Ravinder, our time is short. I think we understand the import of what you're saying there as well. This is real sharp concern on this religious and cultural diversity front in India. It's interesting, Prashant Agarwal with us in New York, you hear people on both sides of this. It can, for an American, it can be a little bit hard to understand, though we know how things can be seen from different views in this country as well, and that these are very different perspectives on the same man, Prashant.
They are, and I think the good thing about the Indian democracy is that whether you're on either side of the 2002 debate, there's a spotlight on it. And going forward for the next 5 years, the BJP is going to most likely assure that there aren't riots. And if there are, you're going to have lots and lots of people covering it. It's going to be on Twitter. It's going to be on Facebook. Mm-hmm. It's going to be all over social media. And that's the beauty of Indian democracy, is that there's not going to be anything hidden at the end of the day. So I don't know if we're ever going to come to a resolution around 2002. What we can come to resolution around is that it shouldn't happen again. And I think that that is the beauty of Indian democracy, is that you've got so many people now watching this that it makes it unlikely to happen in the future.
I mean, that would be great if you're right. But, of course, it has continued to happen not only in Gujarat. This is a Muslim woman here, a little tape from western Uttar Pradesh, talking with CNN after a riot there. Muslims were attacked in late 2013, just last year.
I saw them butcher my husband and so many others, she says. Hindus and Muslims in our village have been living in harmony for generations. I never imagined they would hurt us.
Ethnic tensions are real all around the world, India included. Prashant Agarwal, please stand by in New York. With us right now from San Francisco, Sonia Falero, writer, journalist. She spent a lot of time in India, author of Beautiful Thing, Inside the Secret World of Bombay's Dance Bars. Sonia Falero, thank you very much for being here.
Tom.
We want to ask you about women in India, but let's go to this bigger picture first. How do you see Narendra Modi's victory and its meaning, Sonia?
Well, I'm personally very distressed by it. I think that we have to be very careful and monitor the situation, because this is a man who has to be judged on his history, and his history as the chief minister of Gujarat for the past 12 years shows that his best friends are big business and billionaires to whom he sells land for literally cents on the dollar, taking from the poor to give to the rich, and in the process causing enormous distress to the poor, to women, and to minorities, which is a situation that, you know, cannot be further compounded in a country that is already suffering with a tremendous number of poor people. And we should make it very clear that Mr. Modi, although this is no doubt a great victory that deserving of huge congratulations, he did receive 31% of the vote, and this is a majority Hindu vote. We have studies that just came out yesterday that show that, in fact, the Muslims who have always voted overwhelmingly for the Congress voted in an even greater number for them this year. It went up to over 44%, and in some states they voted by 90% for the Congress. So let us not pretend that this is a vote that has come from the majority of the country, because it has not.
And yet, Sonia, India has been seen as a country that has not had enough growth to pull its very large impoverished population out of that poverty under the Congress party. You can, from outside, we can well understand people looking for something different, something new.
Absolutely. And I think people have the right to make that choice. I don't believe that India needs to have dynasty. I don't believe that India needs to have the same party in power for, you know, nth number of years. Nevertheless, I do believe that we need a prime minister who values human life. And I'm very sorry to say that Mr. Modi has not shown that he does. And as far as, you know, particularly the weaker segment, who, in my mind, are the poor and women, he has failed us.
I can imagine Prime Minister, soon to be Prime Minister Modi, saying to you, I value human life. I want to crank up the rate of growth so that we can pull more people out of poverty.
No, I want to give you one small example of why I think Mr. Modi does not, in fact, value human life. You know, in 2007, Tom, he named a woman called Maya Kodnani to the state's, listen to this, Ministry for Women and Child Development. Maya Kodnani, there is hugely documented evidence to show that she was extremely active during the riots. And we're talking about riots where women, pregnant women, were disemboweled with swords and their fetuses paraded at the tip of those swords around the city. He made this woman the head of his Ministry of Women and Children's Development, claiming that he didn't know that she was involved in the riots when he was chief minister, present physically in the state. 2 years later, Kodnani was put into jail by the Supreme Court while she was still in power for being the mastermind that led to the killings of over 90 people.
Wynn in Chicago, Illinois. Wynn, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you very much for the courtesy. Respectfully, I think this discussion, which is very engaging indeed, overlooks the main point which should cause bigger fears, and that is that while Congress was somewhat sensitive to literally bulldozing native peoples out of their traditional lands, like those in Chhattisgarh. It seems that Prime Minister-elect Modi would not have any such compunctions. And I think that is the big thing which would even widen the rift in inequality. So that's my point. Thank you.
Nguyen, I appreciate your call. Prashant, how do you look at this? On the one hand, here's a leader who will, as we said right off the bat, will lay down the red carpet for business in a big way. And you hear the criticism in that he'll sort of steamroll the poor. On the other hand, in Gujarat, he brought reliable electricity power to all of its 18,000 villages. That hasn't been done, to my knowledge, anywhere else in India. That's a pretty big life changer in power terms. How do you do the math to get to the sum of his impact for the non-billionaire set of India, Prashant?
I think that the only way out of poverty for India is growth, and that is what Modi is for. I have deep respect for Sonia. I think that Modi does have deep respect for human life, and he wants all of India to do better. So he does do economic growth. He also does development. He's brought electricity to people. He's brought potable toilets to people. People have difficulty going to the bathroom in India. And he's made that a priority.
There's just no place to go. There aren't toilets.
There's just no. Yeah, exactly.
So it's outside and off you go.
And that's something that, you know, the people of Gujarat have very much welcomed. The poor people of Gujarat. You don't get elected chief minister three times in any part of India without doing development and without doing good governance. And that is what he is about. I think it's a bit unfair. It's extremely unfair to say that he doesn't have regard for human life. He does. He cares for people. He wants India to do better. He wants all of India to do better. And I think Sonia's right. We have to worry about the minorities. We have to worry about women. We have to worry about everyone. And I think he is concerned across the board.
Sonia, I spent a lot of time in India, much of it as quite a young man, was actually taken to jail during Indira Gandhi's emergency, just briefly, but for talking with Gandhian independence leaders who were not happy with her heavy hand during that time. There's been a lot of development, but clearly the Congress Party outran its welcome here. I mean, it really lost big time. You can't ignore that, can you? In a democracy, Indians have spoken, as they say.
Absolutely. Indians have spoken. Mr. Modi is going to be our prime minister. And, you know, I welcome the fact that he has made development and growth his platform, and I hope he follows through on all his promises. That would be the best thing for India if he fulfilled the promises, the magnificent promises that he's made to Indians. 100 new cities, bullet trains, cleaning up the Ganga, the new centuries, India's century. Listen, as an Indian, as a woman, as a minority, you don't think that these are my dreams as well? They certainly are. But we know from Gujarat, statistically speaking, let me give you two strong statistics.
Okay.
918 women for every 1,000 men in Gujarat, a number which is already far below the scandalously low national average.
Meaning female infanticide? Is that what that means?
Absolutely. It hints at the magnitude of female infanticide. I was in Gujarat recently for a New York Times op-ed that I wrote on the government's attempt to take over of local women's councils. And I found out that the situation is so dire in Gujarat's tribal areas that other upper caste men who cannot find wives, seeking an heir, they end up buying low-caste teenage brides. Once these brides bear them a son, they are discarded and the brides are bought by another upper-caste man. The second thing we know for a fact about Gujarat, and these facts come from Oxfam India, is that more than one in three married women is a victim of domestic violence. Again, domestic violence, unfortunately, takes place all over India. What doesn't happen in the rest of India is what happened in Gujarat, which is Gujarat's largest city, Ahmedabad, has a population of approximately 14 million, if I'm not mistaken. The government appointed one person, to register complaints of spousal abuse, under a 2005 National Anti-Domestic Abuse Law. One person, 14 million people, was dealing with 800 cases in 6 months and didn't have an office.
That's a pretty telling statistic. That's a gigantic, ridiculous caseload. One more call, if I may. Forgive me, Sonia. Mira is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Mira, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'd like to say Mahatma Gandhi and Modi, Narendra Modi, are both native to the state of Gujarat.
Yes.
And I often find amongst leaders in India that there's a complete hypocrisy. We literally worship Gandhi as a god, but we don't follow his philosophy. He said the future of India lies in its villages. There is no rural development or very little rural development. And I hope and pray that Modi, who incidentally I would have not given my vote to, but I want to look ahead optimistically, that he will do good for the country and there will be a trickle-up approach in the rural areas with good strategies for education and health and job opportunities, just like he will have very good strategies, I'm sure, for economic development in the urban areas and the center.
So bring it from both top and bottom, you say, Meera, and I appreciate your call. Our time is so short. Prashant Agarwal, I've stood in that little room where Mahatma Gandhi famously spun in Ahmedabad in Gujarat, his spinning wheel there. What about the odds of development from top and bottom under Narendra Modi?
I think Modi knows very well that 70% of India still lives in the rural areas and that you need to develop that. He's done that in Gujarat. If you actually look at agriculture success in Gujarat has far outstripped other states in India. I think Sonia is right. You have to do rural development. And as the caller pointed out, I think Modi's record speaks to that. That is why India voted for him in droves. And I think it's important that people keep an eye out for this. And I think we're lucky to have people that will do that.
Sonia, I've got 15 seconds. Your best piece of advice to India's soon-to-be new prime minister?
Please keep your promises and remember that India is a secular country.
From Sonia Falero, author of Beautiful Thing, joining us today from San Francisco. Sonia, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
And Prashant Agarwal at Alex Partner, investment manager there in New York City, fellow at CSIS, contributing editor for GQ India. Prashant, you're terrific to be with us. Thanks for your insights. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. Good luck, India. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.